You're listening to Green Mountain Medicine, an original podcast series by ACP Vermont for all things internal medicine. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And we're your hosts.
This series aims to unpack the complexity of medicine in a nuanced and evidence-based way. We invite you to relax, grab some coffee, maybe some tea, maybe you're just a water person, and engage with us as we discuss the topics that impact our field and characterize our practice.
Today, we are lucky to have Dr. Creamer Wahlberg. I can give a little background on him. So he studied bioengineering at Washington State University, where he was a four-year oarsman on the men's crew team before going on to complete medical school at the University of Washington School of Medicine. He then made the move to the University of Vermont for internal medicine residency, where he served as a chief resident. And then currently, he is a physician of cardiovascular medicine here at UVM. So we're so excited to have you. And yeah, we can't wait to get into it.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Katie. And hey, thanks so much for the invitation. This is something I've been looking forward to and really excited to chat. That was an awesome intro, by the way. I was like, I don't know where you found that or how you made it, but that's awesome.
This wonderful place called Google. It has all this information on you, which is a little scary, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's so funny. I was like thinking about some things I might say here in a little bit about stuff that maybe people wouldn't know about me. And one of them was that I was a rower in college. There you go. Sounds like it's out there and people know about that. So that's good.
Yeah, the cat is out of the bag. But the most important question is, what seat did you row? And tell us a little bit more about your rowing career, I guess.
Oh, that's funny. So do any of you have a rowing background?
I do have a rowing background.
Okay. You must if you ask that question. So that's like, I always feel like I joke, I was a lightweight rower, but I was the stroke seat. And I didn't get into rowing until college. I was a runner and played soccer and various things in high school and growing up. And then I had some friends that rowed in college. And then I got into it as a freshman. And it's one of those interesting sports that in a lot of places you can kind of get into. I feel like in college, if you have somewhat of interest or a background in some endurance sports and things, and you can do pretty well in it. And so it was a lot of fun. And I sort of joke that in some ways, like rowing is a little bit like medical school or like residency. And it's sort of, you get into this like group of people in your family and it's like everybody you surround yourself with is kind of rowers or people that you go out somewhere, you go to parties. That's what everybody's talking about. And I feel like for better or for worse, sometimes it's like that in medical school or in residency. If you go somewhere and you have some people who aren't in your medical cohort, you kind of feel bad sometimes with the conversations, like always about work or medicine or rowing or something. But no, rowing's a lot of fun. And I feel like it's somewhat back in pop culture a little bit now with the Boys in the Boat movie. I haven't seen it yet. I read the book, which, and so I'm super excited to see the movie. And I feel like the book was a way that somebody sort of captured rowing, because it's one of those things, like I feel like if you haven't done it or if you don't know a lot about the sport, it's kind of hard to describe it to people. But I feel like the book really did an awesome job of kind of capturing some of the kind of intangible things that are unique to the sport and sort of the way it feels and, you know, and some of those things that all of us that have done it like to talk about. And so I'm super excited to see how it's portrayed in the movie.
I think it's interesting with rowing. I feel like it's a very disciplined sport. And so I'm sure that kind of pays off well to like learn those strategies early on. I actually started rowing my freshman year of high school, believe it or not. I was very privileged to have a crew team at my high school. And it was just something that I figured I would give a try. And then like it turned out that I was a pretty good five seat, which is known as the power seat. So yeah, always trying to bring that strength. And it was awesome. I honestly miss rowing, but I wonder, are there like crew teams around here, like on Lake Champlain? I'm sure that would be like such a beautiful spot.
I know. I looked into it actually. Yeah, because I miss it too. And I, you know, it's hard to get back to Washington State and Pullman as much as I would like now since I moved to Vermont. But we have, you know, an alumni day once a year where we go in the alumni, you know, field boats and race against the team and stuff. And so I'd like to get back. But there is a club team here, you know, affiliated with UVM. I think they actually row, don't quote me on this, but I think they actually row on, it's one of the rivers. It's probably the Winooski, I guess. I'm not sure. But they row on, I think, one of the rivers as opposed to Lake Champlain itself. But I looked into it when I moved here 8 years ago. I never kind of fully got around to it. But I bet you there's a community program or something you can do. Every once in a while, I see somebody with a shell on their roof, you know, driving around. So I'm sure people row on the bays or various things in the lake.
It's such a beautiful sport. Kramer, you spoke a little bit about how you were living in Washington and how you went to undergrad at Washington State and then medical school at the University of Washington. How does living in Vermont compare to the West Coast, and which one do you like better?
It's going to be tough to say which one I like better. I will say, like, a simple way, I'll go into some details, because, and it's so funny, I do a lot of recruitment, or I participate in recruitment for the fellowship and the residency. So I feel like part of me wants to jump into like this little thing I'd say for everybody when I talk about like why I like Vermont and UVM so much. But I feel like it has a lot of the things I loved about living in Seattle and the Pacific Northwest without necessarily as much of the people, or I should say, you know, as busy as it is without all the traffic and as much of the high cost of living and things like that, but still with all of the access to the outdoors and everything. So, I mean, I think what attracted us here was just that we never really thought we were going to live in a big city someday. You know, I grew up outside of Seattle, but my wife's from Montana and all of my family is originally from Montana too. And actually they've since moved back. So that's kind of when we go back to visit home or family, we go to Montana. And so like Burlington is this awesome blend of being in a university college town, of course, with this awesome medical center where we can work and practice in kind of a professional academic environment, but also not have to spend a lot of effort and time to do things. You know, it doesn't take much time at all to go downtown, go to the lake, go to the mountains, go hiking or go skiing. All that is just really kind of at your fingertips. And so when I say it sort of has a lot of the positives and things I like from a cultural standpoint of, you know, the Northwest and Montana, it has that, but also kind of with the blend of being kind of the college town and access to a lot of those other things. It's kind of funny when we go back to visit our family in Montana, like my family lives in kind of one corner of the state and Beth's family lives 8 hours away, driving 80 miles an hour on the interstate. So, you know, it's such a huge state that although they are in one state, you know, they're so far apart. And oftentimes it's three flights too, which is kind of tricky. That's the one thing I don't like about it, far away it is from family and how challenging sometimes it can be or difficult to get back. So it's hard because there's never one place that has everything, right? So I think it depends when you ask about what you like better. I suppose it depends on what particular factor you're focusing on. But I will say that, you know, this place is really special and has a lot of the blend of a lot of the things that we were looking for.
Yeah, I absolutely agree in how Burlington is such a college town, but it also has so much to offer for outdoors lovers. And if you love to ski or you love to climb, and it's just a really wonderful place with like so many different experiences. Would you see yourself living here for a long time or possibly going back to the West Coast just because your family is out there?
That's a tough question. I mean, I think we'll have to see how you know, where life goes and how things transpire. I mean, I think we're certainly of the mindset where we are extremely happy here and we could see ourselves being very happy here for the long period. I mean, that's kind of what factored into our decision, you know, when opportunities became available for us to apply for jobs and to be able to stay here, we sort of had that in mind, you know, was this a place we would love to stay? We have an almost 2-year-old daughter and, you know, this is of course a wonderful place to raise family and we love our lifestyle here and we love our professional, you know, opportunities and jobs here. So all of those things are perfect. Of course, we wish we could be closer to family. So, you know, if life circumstances change for whatever reason at some point in the future, then absolutely. I mean, I think one of the nice things about one of the privileges, I guess, about being in medicine is that, you know, we do have a lot of opportunities in some ways to look for jobs elsewhere, especially in internal medicine and cardiology. You know, my wife is a primary care physician and you know, we all know how much of a need there is for primary care and, you know, and things like that. And so there certainly is a need. And so sometimes, you know, I've known lots of people who have transitioned over the course of their careers to various places. And I think that's one of the privileges about medicine is that sometimes you have the ability to do that if your life, you know, changes such that you need to.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I know it's a little cheesy, but I guess home is where the heart is. So if your immediate family's here and your love of medicine's here, then this is your home. So
I love that, Katie. That's great.
I know is that like Nicholas Sparks? I don't know. Am I quoting someone?
It sounds good. I wouldn't know that reference. I know he's an author, but I don't, I wouldn't have a ton of personal familiar with all the work.
So speaking a little bit more about the heart, since Katie, you brought it up, I was wondering what specific areas within cardiology you focus on, Kramer, and why you're interested in these.
Yeah, I think so. I'm a general cardiologist, but I think that can mean a lot of different things. And if you look at jobs across the country, that can mean a lot of different things. I mean, I think what that often means from a training standpoint is that I did, you know, the 3 years of cardiology fellowship, but nowadays you can often do lots of extra sub fellowships within cardiology. But I sort of, after my 3 year fellowship, I went into practice what I am now. And I think, you know, what my job now is an awesome blend of a lot of different things that was initially actually what got me interested in cardiology in the first place. When I was in your shoes, just the beginning of my third year, I had the opportunity just kind of serendipitously to spend a lot of time with a general cardiologist. Actually, did interventional as well, but with a cardiologist in a smaller practice during part of my medicine rotation. And what I saw was literally over the course of a day, and certainly from day to day, they were constantly doing many different things. It was change in practice setting, clinic, hospital. They were doing procedures, they were reading echoes, they were doing stress tests. And it was so cool to see all these different things. And then in cardiology, we have a lot of our own testing, and we not only sort of order it and do it, but we interpret that testing too. So it's really fun, I think, to be able to do all those things. So my job right now kind of looks like that. Each day, honestly, is a little different. And sometimes weeks can vary too. You know, in the clinic, I see pretty much as much sort of general cardiology as you can. And what I mean by that is someone who gets referred in from primary care or other, you know, specialists for someone to see a cardiologist. Most of those people could theoretically funnel through my clinic. And then if I can usually deal with most of that, but oftentimes there's times where I need to ask for help from my colleagues as well. And I might refer them on to, say, an electrophysiologist or an interventional cardiologist or an advanced heart failure cardiologist. It's really fun to have that variety. And then, you know, I also work in the inpatient side, and that takes the form of attending on the inpatient cardiology service. So anybody that gets admitted to the hospital with, you know, a heart attack or heart failure. Then I also attend on the consult service, which is where we sort of help out with anybody who's admitted to any other non-cardiology service in the hospital, with any sort of general cardiology or heart failure questions. And that often includes ICU patients as well. So I feel like I'm seeing all aspects of cardiology, which is really fun. And not just from an interesting standpoint, but it also from my standpoint early in my career, it helps me kind of keep up to date and kind of keep and developing my practice and getting exposure to these things. But then some days I'll also be reading echoes in the echo lab. Yesterday, the whole day I was doing transesophageal echoes or TEEs while the interventional cardiologist and electrophysiologist were putting in these Watchman devices. So there's just kind of different, you know, angles of things that you can do that helps keep everything interesting, I think. And you know, of course, things will change, right? Cardiology is changing rapidly. And so who knows what this will look like, you know, 5 to 10 years from now.
Thanks so much for sharing that with us. And I mean, that's a lot to keep track of. And it's really interesting that you mentioned how varied what you do is on a day-to-day basis. I'm sure that keeps things really interesting for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it does. And I think, again, that's all I know. So it's I can't sort of compare it to someone who does sort of the same thing every day. But there's lots of people too that, you know, if you look, this is my job sort of being in somewhat of a more academic environment, you know, and I also, as you know, spend a lot of time teaching, and that's where I met you all. And then I still participate in research. There's lots of other general cardiologists in the country who don't necessarily work in as sort of an academic, you know, environment, and they may spend 4 days a week in the office, and that's kind of what they do. And then in between visits or, you know, 1 half day a week or alternating, they might be reading stress tests and echoes and various things, and maybe seeing a patient or two as in consultation in the hospital. So your practice setting kind of really can change what you do. And actually, I think that's one of the neat things about cardiology is that there are so many different opportunities. And, you know, if you figure out kind of what your interests are, what makes you tick or what things you like, you can often find, you know, an environment or a practice that kind of fits your interests, both from sort of a medical standpoint, but then also a lot of those things I talked about have applications for what your lifestyle is like, you know, how much call you take or, you know, how long you work, how much you work, those types of things.
I know you mentioned a little bit earlier about also like the geographic flexibility, which another aspect as well, you know, if you do choose to move, kind of having that job mobility and flexibility. So yeah, sounds like a great path.
Yeah, I love it. And I would do it again in a heartbeat if I had to. That's nice. I feel fortunate that I'm able to say that, you know, because before we started recording, we were talking a little bit about how, you know, before you know it, you know, residency applications are going to be coming around the corner for you all. And it's just wild how fast the process goes.
Yeah, I'm a little nerve-wracking, but exciting. Kramer, you spoke about how you have many different roles. You're either working on the consult service or inpatient cardiology or working with patients that require echoes or stress tests. Was there ever a patient that or a very memorable patient success story that highlights the impact of cardiology on people's lives?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, I think when I hear a question like that, one of the things that comes to mind is, of course, I think some of the, you know, really sick patients that come in, or some of the, yes, I don't want to be this term in like a weird way, but some of the more flashy kind of stories that can happen. I mean, something that really comes to mind was some point last year. And I honestly didn't even know about the story until it happened. So I sort of was experiencing this in real time. But, you know, a lot of times we'll have meetings where everybody comes together for various things. And so we were at a monthly meeting where we were reviewing cases to talk about kind of what went well, what didn't, or how can we improve a lot of those. And at the end of it, a patient came in, like a patient walked into this meeting, which is normally just a meeting of, you know, doctors and staff and nurses and techs and everybody. And the patient came in, and the story behind this was that this patient, I think, had a cardiac arrest at home, you know, came into the emergency room at the code and was having a massive heart attack. I'm probably paraphrasing this a little bit, but this is, I think, my understanding of it. Was a, you know, extremely critically ill, and then, you know, went to the cath lab and they supported him and they fixed the, I think they opened up the blockage, and I think he went to the ICU on a pump for a couple of days, but eventually got better, right? And so, I mean, I think and then he ended up walking in, you know, to this meeting with all of the people, which was awesome to see. And, you know, he was giving folks hugs, and it was a super emotional moment. I wasn't even someone who was personally connected to the case. I mean, so of course, things like that stand out about how, you know, cardiovascular disease being, you know, of course, the number one, you know, killer in this country, how, you know, technology and also systems of care, right? So this person received immediately good, you know, CPR and life support and advanced care life support and cardiac life support and those things, you know, from the emergency response teams throughout the emergency room, all aspects of our systems, including the technology available to treat him, you know, supported him through this such that he could get back to his family, you know, and in his life. And so I think that those things, you know, of course, are really poignant and stand out. But I think that, you know, I think cardiology, one of the really neat things about it, and this is, you know, of course, the same with lots of other specialties too, but there's a lot of things that we almost take for granted now that really dramatically improve patients' lives and quality of life. I think about pacemakers. I was talking to a patient about that just the other day. I mean, it's just a common thing we're used to now, but, you know, if you think about it, I mean, that's something people, you know, if they came in with heart block or something that was really serious and untreatable in the past, now you can get a pacemaker and they can just live, you know, a normal life and going about their daily routine, you know, without any major limitations. Or, you know, some patients who have these arrhythmias, you know, SVTs or various things that can be really limiting their quality of life. Some of these things are actually curable by the electrophysiologist. They go in and find this one spot in the heart where the short circuit is, and they can fix that, you know? And so there's a lot of neat things, I think, that technology and, you know, just the science have advanced in cardiology such that we can really improve people's quality of life, which is really the goal, I think, make them live longer, improve their quality of life to get them back to doing what they enjoy and get them back to their families.
That must have been such a rewarding experience to have the patient who at one moment was having a cardiac arrest and then was coming in and being able to communicate with you and thank you for your service and everything that you were doing. So I can't even imagine what that felt like at that time, but it must have been really great.
Yeah, no, it was really emotional. Again, I didn't actually have anything to do with the case. I was just kind of there in the meeting. And so I was in some ways as kind of shocked as most people. I didn't, you know, so it was really neat. And I think it's interesting. A lot of times in medicine, we don't always know what happened. You know, I mean, we're involved with patients' care at various points along their course. I think unless you're taking care of them in the outpatient setting, and that's, and one of the other things I love about my job is that I not only see folks in the hospital, but I get to know them over years, or I will get to know them over years, you know, throughout my career, and take care of them in the clinic to follow them on their journey and get to know them. But I think that so often we're kind of meeting people at various points and fragmented aspects of their care in the hospital. And so sometimes we don't always know, you know, what happened. And so it was a really special moment for that to kind of come back full circle.
So our next question is, what are some of the common misconceptions about heart health that you often encounter in your patients? And I guess also, how do you go about addressing or educating your patients on these matters?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I'd actually be curious too, if there's anything that's on your mind, because I think, you know, before I even get into that, I'm always sort of surprised and humbled, you know, all the time when we're talking with, like when I'm talking with friends and family members or patients, you know, I think it's really important to get to know people and actually understand their perspective and where they're coming from and sort of ask these kind of open-ended questions to actually and not assume that someone knows something or doesn't know something, because it's really, I think, humbling to understand their perspective and get to the root of some of these issues. I mean, I think one of the things that I often comes to mind, and I don't see this honestly as much as I would like to. I think I really enjoy prevention and to talking to patients about prevention, and I do see a fair amount of that. Although I think a lot of that is also handled, you know, in the primary care offices as well. I think I hear and I see a lot of people sometimes talk about how they, you know, their numbers may suggest that, you know, they have high cholesterol, for example, or they have a couple of things that aren't great, but because of XYZ, maybe because they work out a ton or because, you know, certain things, they feel like their risk actually isn't that high. And maybe I'll change this framework, because, you know, when we talk about somebody's risk, oftentimes we punch their numbers into a calculator and it gives us like an estimate of their risk of having an event in 10 years. I'm not sure if that sounds familiar to any of you all yet, but it will once you're in your clinical years. And so, you know, sometimes that risk isn't super high. Like if somebody's young, age is, you know, something we can't control. And as your age goes up, your risk goes up. And if you're younger, that risk isn't going to be as high, especially if we're only looking 10 years down the road. And so every once in a while, I have conversations with people who get referred whose, you know, cholesterol is super high, or they have something that, you know, really increases their risk. But if you kind of look just 10 years down the road, that risk isn't going to be as high because they're 40 years old or something like that. And so we try to have these conversations about kind of, I think, the importance of prevention and how this is really like a lifelong journey, right? It's about how long your body's exposed to these things. Your cholesterol is ridiculously high for 30 or 40 years, then over those 30 to 40 years, you're going to accumulate that exposure to that, and it's going to increase your risk of having events. I try to tell them, it's like, I'm not trying to prevent you from having an event 10 years from now. I'm trying to prevent you 30 to 40 years from now, you know? And so I think helping to kind of reframe these things and how ultimately it comes down to so much of cardiovascular disease is preventable. And a lot of this is based upon, which we can get into more if you want later, but it's based on a lot of things that are kind of behavioral or societal norms and things that have been sort of just accepted. And unfortunately, there's a lot of it that's structural and related to, you know, healthcare disparities and other factors that, you know, we don't have a medicine. There's no medicine that's going to treat that. A lot of these things, unfortunately, are related to policy and societal factors that I don't have a good solution for. So I kind of went on a little tangent there, but I think having those conversations, I think, are interesting. And, you know, I think just if you have a lot of cardiovascular risk, I think just because you exercise a whole bunch doesn't mean you have the license to go off and eat whatever you want to. I mean, I think those things are not necessarily mutually exclusive. So.
And when I was thinking about this question myself, I was more thinking from my own perspective as a medical student, what surprised me in our cardiology units. And I personally was surprised to hear about some of the internal changes that you can start seeing in the cardiovascular system, even in like young adults. So like, you know, starting to see fatty streaks and lipid engorged macrophages, all that good stuff, bad stuff in like young adults, and educating patients about that, because I didn't know that, and giving patients information to, I know it's scary to think about, but X number of years down the road, like this, your health is going to be impacted by the choices that you make now, which I think is really interesting. I also like that you mentioned the point about social determinants of health, because, you know, even though heart disease is so preventable, you know, sometimes like with the resources that folks have, it's really hard to prevent.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I feel like it is probably one of the most important things. And I wish I had a solution for it. You know, I remember we talked and we looked at some graphs in class, and, you know, you can go online, you can find a lot of these data sets online where you can plug in various things like hypertension or, you know, who knows, any of the different cardiovascular risk factors. And you can actually break them down by county, and oftentimes even within county, within neighborhoods in various cities across the country. And it's shocking to look at, you know, the outcomes just by changing your zip code or changing, you know, a few streets. And that's all just related to, you know, those social determinants of health and other factors that you mentioned. And I also remember when I was in your shoes, I remember exactly where I was sitting. I was in my second year class in cardio, and the pathologist was up there, and she showed pictures of those fatty streaks on the aorta. And she said, like, most of you have these now. And I was like, what? No way. It starts that early. We all have these things. And so you're totally right. It's atherosclerosis, and is so interesting. And I think it's important to do what we can to always be having those tough conversations with our patients to try and help them, you know, understand those things.
I found it interesting how you were talking a lot about your interest in prevention and essentially how social norms play a part in increasing cardiovascular risk factors. And Haley and I started to think about there's such an overlap between law and medicine. Mm-hmm. And for example, we saw how in Vermont, there was an increase in the price of nicotine products, an increase in the age of eligibility to purchase to 21. So in your opinion, what role do you see for public awareness campaigns or law in promoting heart health and making these changes from a system level?
I think they're super important. And you're absolutely right. I think Vermont is leading the way in some ways in that. I don't want to pretend to be an expert on this because I'm not at all. But so I just know kind of honestly what I've heard and what I've heard about, and or at least the way I've heard about some of these things has come from, you know, organizations like the American Heart Association or other sort of these large organizations, which have the resources to be able to support these things. And, you know, I think this kind of gets to the broader concept that I think as healthcare professionals, our voices oftentimes carry some weight, whether and sometimes whether we realize it or not. And so that has sort of implications for life in general, I think. But that also means, I think, for people who, you know, who are interested in advocacy or who have, you know, the desire to do this, I think you can actually enact change. And I'm not someone who personally has a lot of experience with it, but I know some people who have and colleagues who have. And I think for people that are interested in it, and if you don't know where to start, I mean, I think one of the ways is sort of partnering with some of these larger organizations, because I think they're always looking for people to help them. Someone who comes to mind, Dr. Gogo, interventional cardiologist here, director of the cath lab, who's been practicing, you know, for a long time here, is someone who has been working hard and a strong advocate. And he's someone who actually was working with the people to help enact that change to raise the age to 21 to being able to buy nicotine products in this state. And I know he's gone to Montpelier to advocate, and he's worked with the American Heart Association. I think it was last year, actually, we were at the local annual Go Red for Women dinner sort of event, and he was presented with an award in recognition of his work and advocacy. So that's just an example of, I think, of how a cardiologist locally has made such a strong impact in this state. So I think that, you know, another thing that comes to mind too is, and I was getting these emails as a fellow of the American College of Cardiology, which is another one of our national organizations. They sponsor, and I'm sure the same opportunity would even be available for medical students if you're interested, but they sponsor interested fellows or trainees to sort of go to their day on the Hill, where they go to the advocacy events, you know, in Washington, D.C., and they're looking for people to speak to lawmakers and sort of to give their perspective on things. And so I think these opportunities are out there for anyone who might be interested in it. And, you know, I think we all probably should be doing as much as we can in that regard.
Yeah, it's difficult to think about how we spoke about this with other physicians who we've interviewed on the podcast, but basically your role as a physician and then your role as like a public health advocate and how those two roles can sometimes be just not in sync. Like you're worried about your day-to-day thing. You're worried about your patients that are individuals rather than a society as a whole and figuring out that balance. But that's amazing that Dr. Gogo can achieve that balance, which is wonderful. Like going and figuring out increasing the age for nicotine is a wonderful step in the right direction. So yeah, I'm glad someone's doing it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I wonder too how it's all going to change or how it has changed and will change with, you know, social media and all these various things. There's so many different ways where people can become more accessible or just visible, I guess. And so I'm sure that'll continue to change. And I think there's even any interest in it. There is probably amongst the general sort of trainee population or students. I mean, I think I certainly hear more and more about it when I'm talking to people who are interviewing to come here for residency, people that have strong interests or already strong, you know, experience in advocacy. I think that I've heard residents over the years talk about, should we have like an actual curriculum for that within residency to sort of get some exposure to it? I think it's something that will probably become more prevalent and probably should be.
Definitely. So I have a quote from the American Heart Association, kind of paraphrasing a Lancet study from 2017 that says that chronic stress has been shown to be associated with increased cardiovascular events, which I'm sure we kind of already presumed by now. So I was just wondering how you think that mental health factors, including stress and anxiety and maybe other conditions, might impact cardiovascular health.
I think they absolutely do, as you described. And I think that fits into a little bit what we were talking about before. It's one of those things that it can be, it's very prevalent and has a real impact, but it, you know, if mitigate that can be challenging and, you know, and obviously different from situation to situation. But, you know, stress absolutely, you know, is a risk factor for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. I mean, I think you mentioned that study, and if you look at the guidelines, they talk about how primary prevention guidelines, they say you should be, you know, screening for, you know, evidence of stress, because this is a real risk factor. I mean, physiologically, we know that it can increase inflammation, you know, it increases your sympathetic nervous system. It has all these other effects that can all increase the likelihood of hypertension, diabetes, or just have direct, you know, increased risk on the cardiovascular system. So I think we all know that. And as you pointed out, the challenge is how to sort of ameliorate that and try to mitigate that. It's actually funny, you mentioned that I was not too long ago working on a case report of a patient who we took care of in the hospital, and the patient has given permission to talk about these things, of course, in sort of an anonymous basis. They did. So I can mention, I think, the details of it, but this is sort of a rather dramatic example of, I think, how stress can, and a very unique example, but I think nonetheless, it sort of brought us down the pathway of kind of thinking more about stress and all of these things. But this patient came in with a stress cardiomyopathy, which, or Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. I'm not sure if that sounds, if you guys are familiar with that, but that's what can happen, where the heart can suddenly become weak and it can mimic a heart attack. And some patients can come in really sick, and it's triggered by some sort of emotional stress on the body. This in particular one, though, was triggered by, or physical stress, not just emotional, but this particular one was triggered by a conversation with a healthcare insurance company, which is a bit ironic in a sense, you know, a conversation with an insurance company about, you know, some issues with insurance coverage, XYZ, you know, to actually trigger this to happen. And that's really got us, that got me looking and doing a literature search a little bit on healthcare related stress. And, you know, I mean, it's there's been a lot published out there on that. So people that have stress related to healthcare costs or difficulty accessing healthcare or just inadequate care, all these different things, that in and of itself, regardless of what the medical consequences are, it imparts a huge amount of stress, you know, and financial stress on this country. And I feel like that's only going to get worse. And so, and unfortunately, that seems to disproportionately affect disadvantaged folks, for whether that's socioeconomical or racial or various things. And so that further, I think, magnifies a lot of the disparities we were talking about before. So I think, to get back to what you're talking about before, absolutely, stress is a major risk factor, and stress can take many forms. And oftentimes, unfortunately, it doesn't, you know, manifest in some sort of acute problem like I was just describing. That was a rare case. It's more that it's like a lot of these things. It's like if you had like uncontrolled blood pressure for many years, you're not going to feel it, but it's going to create problems for you down the year or down the road after many, many years of exposure to that.
Absolutely. And I think gets back to the point that like our current health really impacts our future health. Our current stresses impact our future health as well. So I guess trying to be mindful of that and making patients aware that, you know, to make healthy choices as much as they can, even starting at early stages in their life for prevention measures.
Absolutely. And it's that. And I think it's also on us to be aware of it and cognizant of it and think about it, right? I think it's easy to think, look at a blood pressure and say, oh, your blood pressure's high, or look at an A1C and say, oh, your blood sugar's high. But how often are we like thinking and engaging? I know I don't do it as much as I should, you know, thinking and engaging folks about that and having those conversations. You know, it takes time. And sometimes those conversations aren't super straightforward. So maybe those are some barriers as to why we don't do it as often as we should. But I think, you know, increased awareness is super important.
Kramer, you spoke about in your field of cardiology, how you have these interventions and medications to prolong the lives of your patients, not only in years, but also in quality. So how do you go about adapting your approach to cardiology care for specifically older adults, considering factors of polypharmacy and other comorbidities?
Yeah, I think that's a complicated question. And I think the short answer is, I think it's very important, but it's also an individualized, you know, you have to have an individualized, personalized approach, you know, to each case. And I think the mistake would be trying to use sort of a cookie cutter kind of standardized approach in those situations. I mean, I think one of the things that I appreciate every day about the path that we have to get through to cardiology is that we all start with internal medicine residency. You know, we get a strong foundation as an internist. And with that, you learn. Unfortunately, I think we're all being trained now about things like polypharmacy that you mentioned and a lot of these other things that I think stick with us. So it's not just that, but it's also, I think, most important to try and actually get to know your patients, what's important to them. You know, what's their lifestyle like? What's their functional status like? Who manages their medications? Do they manage their medications? What are their goals? You know, what's their life expectancy? What other problems do they have? How many other doctors are they seeing? Many of my patients are seeing, you know, like six or seven different people, right? So all these things are matter to them and should impact, I think, your decision making on what to offer them. I think our job is still to make a medical assessment and recommendation as to, you know, what may be the options, but then to help the patients navigate those options within their own philosophy of care and their own goals, and to help sort of arrive at the right shared decision. And so that in some ways answers your question. It really is an individualized approach. And I think that we're being trained that way now. You know, I mean, I think not just from recognizing those things, you know, the risk of polypharmacy or these various things in the older population, but then also I think throughout training, getting exposure to training and conversations around serious illness and navigating these conversations with patients and their families and figuring out how to ask patients questions in the right way to understand what their goals of care are or to frame these decisions.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I love the point that you make about how goals of care for the individual patient and how possibly there could be a little bit of bias as the physician just being like, this is how I see the quality of life, you know, and this is how I would want to live my life at your age. So I'm going to do these things. And then, but actually hearing the patient and hearing what their day-to-day life looks like, and then going about the medications or interventions with that mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. That's super important. And I think it will continue to be even more important. You know, cardiology is one thing that I know, but I think that you can see parallels in lots of other specialties too. You know, as science and technology advances, there's always going to be more things we can do. There's always going to be more medications. And unfortunately, a lot of them also come with a lot of resources, a lot of cost. And so I think that's a whole separate issue that we hadn't even really talked about. But so I think it's going to be the behoove of us to even be more aware of this as the years go on.
So believe it or not, we're coming up on the 150-year anniversary of the EKG. Yeah, soon.
I should know that, seeing as how we talked about that in class. I don't recall the exact year, but yeah.
It looks like the first EKG was read back in 1887. So very impressive, because I feel like it might be one of the longest standing diagnostic tools out there. And we were just wondering, in a fun way, what do you see for the future of the EKG?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's going anywhere, but I do think it'll change how we interact with. I mean, it has in many ways, because, well, so the fact that it makes it so valuable, and it's kind of amazing, actually, when you think about it. It's one of the oldest sort of diagnostic tests, if you will, that we have. And really, we're just kind of capturing sort of the electrical activity of the heart by these leads that we stick on the chest. But, you know, it's really tough to beat something that you can perform and interpret in real time at the bedside that's ubiquitous, easy to do, and relatively cheap. And it can really help you diagnose emergencies, right? I mean, one of the ways we can diagnose, you know, obviously STEMIs and other sort of acute problems, but we can diagnose tachycardias or bradyarrhythmias, all these different things. And so, you know, for that reason, I don't see it really going anywhere. How it's already changed, you know, I've only known this, but I can imagine 40, 50 years ago, things were different. But now everything's digitized. So we interpret all of course, we get the paper printout, but like we interpret our ECGs on the computer, and the computer already allows us to kind of zoom in and move things around or adjust the gain and all these different things that can help already improve, I think, our accuracy and easily compare someone's EKG now to one from 15 years ago, right? We can just pull that up in the computer. So that's been helpful. But I think what's really going to change, and what is already happening, and it's in active area of research, is where AI is going to come involved. Clinical research going on now, and actually a product that's, I think, available for some people to use if they want. But for example, that's looking at AI and interpreting ECGs and diagnosing coronary occlusion. So, you know, STEMI, obviously, this is what it is, because it oftentimes means you have a full occlusion of the artery. And of course, you need to open that artery, you know, as soon as possible. But there's oftentimes, I shouldn't say often, but sometimes patients present and they have an occluded artery, but they don't necessarily have STEMI criteria on their EKG, right? There's different ways we can clinically infer that, maybe, and say this patient needs to go to the cath labs, you know, more quickly than somebody else. But a lot of people have hypothesized and published that there's more subtle findings on EKGs or things that aren't classically STEMI criteria. And so they've actually done research on this, and AI is quite good at picking these things up. And there's actually ongoing trials right now of using some of these programs for that. So I could easily see that as happening. And then literally yesterday I was on Twitter, and one of the really famous echocardiographers from the Mayo Clinic tweeted something out about, because Mayo does a lot of these AI studies too, how they're using like AI tools to look at an EKG and predict whether somebody has elevated pressures in their heart or whether they have diastolic dysfunction, which is totally wild to me, because EKGs are looking at electrical activity, you know, and here you are trying to infer from that whether somebody's got diastolic. And so it's interesting that maybe there's a lot more information there that we realize that we can't, I guess, infer as subtly as, you know, AI can, who, you know, these AI models are trained on that tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of EKGs. And so they can pick up these subtle things. So that's one way I think it might change in the future.
That's so cool. And I'm really glad that you brought up AI, because obviously it's fascinating. And I think Katie has a question for you, a little bit digging more into this topic.
Yeah, this is the last question of the interview. And it does involve AI, and we've read about the possible future uses of machine learning, specifically in cardiology, with gene editing and for cardiac conditions. So other than the really interesting example that you just gave, are there any emerging technologies in cardiology that you believe will have a significant impact in the near future? And do you think that humans may be replaced by AI? Is the human touch still needed for cardiology?
Well, I think absolutely. Yeah, I guess I don't see, well, who knows, right? I mean, I think it's so funny. I think history is humbling in that way, where we aren't very good at predicting the future as well as we think. But I would be hard pressed to find, you know, a reason anytime soon where people would be replaced. I mean, I think there's clinical decision-making piece alone, but then also there's just the human aspect of it, right? I mean, I think that's so important to doctoring, and that's, you know, the communication piece and just being able to understand who our patients are is somewhat irreplaceable, I think, let alone the medical decision-making thing, which is where I think a lot of us maybe think about the AI piece. I can't imagine it won't be helping us along the way, right? You know, and providing some guidance. But I think one of the cool things about cardiology is just how rapidly everything is changing. And I think, you know, there's certainly a lot of money that goes into cardiology research and into the technologies and the devices and the drugs, everything like that. But I mean, some of the things that come to mind. So, you know, in interventional cardiology, there's this whole field of structural cardiology now where we're doing interventions on the heart, replacing valves percutaneously, meaning through catheters that go in the leg, as opposed to, you know, open heart surgery. They're now doing more valves and doing different techniques on those that didn't exist 5 to 10 years ago. And that field is going to continue changing. That's exciting for me because I sort of help out in those procedures in the sense where I do the transesophageal echo to provide visualization for that. But I think that that's it's going to be really interesting to see where that goes, you know, within the world of electrophysiology and pacemakers. It used to be that pacemakers were kind of just implanted in the heart, just in there. And now they're actually putting in the pacemaker leads into the body's natural conduction system, which is super cool. So it's like you're pacing the heart, you know, when possible through the body's natural wires, which is awesome. It's sort of more of a natural, holistic way to pace. You mentioned gene editing. It was actually at American Heart Association meeting in November. There was like a very early kind of pilot study on this. It was 10 patients where they used the CRISPR. I'm not an expert in this, but you know, the CRISPR gene editing technology, patients who had familial hypercholesterolemia, and that showed that giving this infusion was able to, you know, lower their LDL and levels of other sort of biomarkers for this. You know, again, I don't know a lot about it, but I think that that's just sort of an example of where this technology is already, you know, moving into early phase, you know, clinical trials and studies. So who knows where that's going to go? But yeah, no, cardiology is really exciting in that way. And it's kind of fun because things are constantly changing, and you know, I fully expect it's only going to continue.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing to see the changes that have happened. And even I'm thinking about bedside ultrasound and how,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
How that's the normal yeah. thing, you know, of like the normal when someone comes in for a cardiac issue or lung issue, it's like, okay, put the probe on them, you know, and I don't know if that was a thing.
No, it's so funny you mentioned that because I sort of honestly just took it for granted. It didn't even occur to me. But, you know, that is new. I mean, relatively new for it to be that routine. And what I think is so neat is that you all get that it's longitudinal throughout your training here at LCOM, which maybe that's becoming more standard too, but I know that never used to be the case. And I think that LCOM was somewhat of a front runner in that regard. And so, yeah, POCUS and ultrasound is so helpful. I know at least within sort of the cardiology fellowship here, when I was just starting out, it wasn't as common for fellows to sort of do that on call. Some did, but now it's just within the last 5 years, I feel like just the culture within, you know, our program has been that more and more are doing it. And so I imagine that's just a little bit of a microcosm for what's happening everywhere. But yeah, absolutely. You know, handheld technology like that is changing the way that we make diagnoses and take care of patients in real time.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of these really interesting points. We love learning about your rowing career. We love learning about your day to day. So this has been such a pleasure, and it's been so nice to talk with you.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, Haley, Kate, this was awesome. Thanks again for the invitation. It was a lot of fun. Best of luck with your step one studying. I know it'll go well, and I'm sure you'll be looking forward to having that behind you.
So excited. I'm reviewing actually my murmurs and all that, and I'm remembering how much I forgot. So it's good.
Yeah, it's tricky, but you'll do well, and it'll feel good to have that on the other side of you. I guess there's one thing. That's the one thing about boards is that, you know, it does force us to kind of go through and review everything and recall everything. So I guess there's that.
All right, folks, if you're still here, thanks for sticking with us. That's it for today on Green Mountain Medicine. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our discussion, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @ACP_Vermont for more podcast updates, or subscribe to us on YouTube at Green Mountain Medicine.